Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our ongoing conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I first started buying esoteric books, occult books, books about UFOs and Buddhas and shamans, probably in the early 90s, 1990s, when about the same time I started writing for Gnosis Magazine, a wonderful magazine that sort of straddled between scholarship and popular seekerdom, focused on the Western esoteric traditions and religious traditions, and a really great kind of a supreme magazine of that era, beautifully produced on a Macintosh and really using the new editing skills that people had their hands on for the first time in the digital domain and using it very well. And it was really a whole interesting world of people who, again, straddled this border. Were they scholars? Were they researchers? Were they historians? Were they magicians? Were they mystics? Were they fans? Were they freaks? It was something in between all that, and it became a fascinating world that I lived largely through reading and writing and communicating, partly over the early internet, but also, of course, in more old-fashioned ways. And one of the great sort of synthesizing objects of my early researches and my early book buying was the Todd Pratum's amazing series of catalogs. Todd Pratum is a long-standing book dealer extraordinaire in matters esoteric, and his catalog not only introduced me to many, many wonderful books that I would not have known about otherwise, but also introduced me to his own remarkable, playful, wonderful, deeply Californian worldview, because unlike a lot of catalogs that you can find out there online and off, Todd took an extraordinary amount of time not only enumerating the bibliographical detail that collectors fetishize, but really giving us a deep sense of his impression of the book. He seemed to read pretty much everything and keep it under his hat somehow and pull it out just at the right time. And it was one of those rare dealers that would tell you what was wrong with a book that he was listing in his catalog, whether it was poorly produced or even whether it was ridiculous in some certain way. And yet that made you even more engaged with his sense of this extraordinary literature, set of literatures about all the rejected knowledge of the modern world, all the things that normal university professors and scientists and New York Times editors and all those keepers of the mainstream sweep under the carpet, you know, from cryptozoology, ufology, mysticism, psychedelics, the whole thing. And I found it all quite lovingly. And every time I'd get these wonderful catalogs, you know, I'd immediately go through it with my pen and circle things that I want and make my lists and send it in. And invariably, some of them had already been sold because there were people who were doing it even more rapidly than I was. I was very happy many years later to finally get to meet Todd in the flesh when I moved to the Bay Area, a place that he's moved through and has been living for quite some time, but has been around the Northern California and Southern California throughout most of his life. So we finally got to hang out. He's one of the many wonderful people that I wish I had had more time to get to know up till now. But I was very pleased to see that in a recent book, a collection of essays surrounding this one remarkable esoteric library in Europe, in Switzerland, Hans Hackel's Octagon, which is an octagon-shaped library. It looks like an extraordinary place, one of these wonderful esoteric libraries. I've had the privilege of visiting a few in my life. And in this volume, which has a lot of esoteric scholars on it, including Jeffrey Kripal and Wouter Honegraaff, both of whom we've had on the show, Also something by Jocelyn Godwin, who refuses to do podcasts, unfortunately. But at the very end, there's a wonderful piece by Todd Pratum called Dark Impressions, 35 Years as a Dealer in Books on the Occult, which is just a wonderful, if all too brief, memoir of a life devoted to not just bibliophilia, but a bibliophilia in a particularly esoteric zone that, as you might imagine, given the topics and given Todd's location in California, brought him in touch with all manner of weirdos and wonderful freaks and sometimes disturbing individuals over his years buying and selling this remarkable arcane material. So with that wonderful piece as a kind of inspiration, I thought I'd ask Todd to come on Expanding Mind and talk about life and books in esoterica. So Todd, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
Well, thank you for that, Erica. It's nice to be here.
You know, it's, I guess it's sort of an obvious place to start, but because, you know, we're both Californians, we both grew up in San Diego area. I was a little bit more north than you growing up in La Jolla, but I would like to hear a little bit about your childhood and how it kind of set up some of these interests, both in terms of the material of esoterica, the occult, mystery traditions, ancient civilizations, but also the what would become your love of the manifestation of those mysteries in the book form.
Well, yes, we both share the, I think, unique experience of growing up in California. You know, Alan Watts had a saying about how Western thought, as we commonly like to think of it, started in Europe and then moved to the East Coast of America, and the seekers and the crazies and the eccentrics, they kept moving west, and then they finally reached California, and they couldn't move any farther, and that's where a lot of them ended up. And I will say that growing up, especially in Southern California, I think is a really unique hotbed of creative thinking and exploration. And but I was a nature kid. I mean, I grew up on the beach. I was a surfer and a skateboarder and that kind of thing. But nature was really the beginning for me, to beginning of my exploration of the mysterious. My father was a psychoanalyst. He was a really brilliant guy. He was a neurologist, and I grew up in a big house with a lot of books, and I was always a reader. So I basically spent my childhood either reading books, surfing on the beach, or exploring nature. And probably around the age of about 16, I first took psychedelics, and that was a powerful window for me to see the world through. And it's kind of unfortunate, I think, that a lot of occultists are not psychedelicized. Don't you think, Eric?
Well, why would you say that? What is it that they're missing out on?
Well, I think what we know now, with a lot of new scholarship that's come out, that psychedelics played a prominent role in all the world's religions, and quite possibly psychedelics may be the origin of religious thinking. And yet, you know, we've been deprived of that in the modern world. All that is now, I mean, has been rejected knowledge, and is only now do we know that a lot of modern people, thinkers and philosophers, did experiment and found that window. And it's not the only window, but it's certainly one of them, and especially psychedelics in nature, doing psychedelics in nature, has been a revelatory experience for so many people, including myself.
Yeah, I think that's a real key, is the way in which it brings you closer to the material, real, actual, organic, biological world that we are completely immersed in. And yet, simultaneous with that intimacy, there's these overtones or patterns or layers or echoes that emerge from that intimacy that, you know, can go so far beyond like a conventional idea of what the natural world is. So it brings us almost closer to matter and then, you know, reveals matter to be something very different than it might appear to an ordinary eye. And in a way, that's really resonates with a lot of the occult and its sort of broad goals as being something that reveals something about nature, something hidden about the mind and the relationship of mind and matter. And so even if it's not in a psychedelic key, for me, I think in a similar to you growing up with this stuff fairly early on, there really wasn't that clear a distinction between these different worlds. They were all kind of feeding into one another, including the surfing and the skateboarding. Although I didn't surf, I skateboarded. But it was all kind of this strange multi-dimensional crossroads in California. And one of the wonderful things about your memoir is just the different parts of California moving north, the different kinds of characters you meet, being in San Francisco in the 70s and 80s, and being on the Hate Street when it was very rough and tumble, and kinds of characters who would come in, the kinds of materials that you would be able to find on the West Coast. So talk a little bit about that. Like, what is it about esoteric books in the West Coast what's that connection like? Because at first people go, oh, well, all the good stuff's in Europe or maybe on the East Coast because that they've been there longer and they're, you know, more wealthy people or more scholars or something. But you have a different impression of the role of the West Coast in the kind of esoteric book world.
Well, that's exactly right. People always think London, Paris, New York, that must be where all the books are, the great libraries, and certainly there are plenty of great libraries there. But I think what's interesting about books in California is that because all these seekers and dreamers and eccentrics migrated to California, they brought their books with them. And so here in California, there's no question that there are more occult books to be found than anywhere else. And it's really been a privilege that I've had to find these books and to meet people that have these libraries. And by the way, I want to just clarify about the term occult. I am going to use that in this conversation, but I think a lot of people are really confused about what the occult is. And a lot of people don't really realize that the word itself is really a modern word. It comes from an old Latin word, but it's now sort of this it's just a catch-all term that it doesn't really have a precise definition. But I like what you said, rejected knowledge. That's essentially what it is. So it can include, you know, the obvious things like alchemy and magic and witchcraft. Certainly those have been very rejected, but it's also unexplained phenomena, UFOs, spiritualism, esoteric religions. And esoteric is also a really good word to use because it really, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about something that is difficult to understand, and it's difficult to understand just with the mind. We have to have something else operating in us to see these deeper strands of history and reality. I will say I think, with a few exceptions, all the really great occult libraries have been built here in California. And in San Francisco, where I moved to San Francisco when I was 18, That's when I learned that San Francisco is the greatest book market in the world, greater than any of those cities I just mentioned. So it's been a romp through a very rich playground of ideas here for me.
Well, and, you also mentioned a lot of really great characters. You know, you tell a lot of good stories in your memoir. But can you give us just an example of some of the, you know, the characters that you encountered in the process of finding and selling and cataloging and reading through this immense literature?
Oh my God, where do you begin?
You talk about Brian.
I was thinking of one guy this morning. This LAPD detective that was peripherally involved with the McMartin case. Are you familiar with that, Eric?
Well, yes, but why don't you let people know a little bit?
Yeah. Well, I don't know too much about it. It was a school in Los Angeles where children started to reveal that they were being tortured, ritually killed. They did blood rituals, you know, all under the instruction of the teachers, and that there were underground tunnels underneath the school. And they eventually actually raised the school and looked for these tunnels. And in the end, I guess it's been more or less shown that it was a kind of mass hysteria, maybe not unlike the Salem witchcraft trials. And although there's still some people that believe that, you know, it really did happen and it was all covered up and that sort of thing. But anyway, this detective, he wanted everything that he could ever get his hands on that had to do with Satanism and witchcraft. He was a very scary guy, I have to say. And towards the end of knowing him, I had my suspicions that he himself was some kind of Satanist. So you have a guy like that. Then you have a guy like Michael Aquino, who I knew for a little while. I met him at Fields Bookstore, which was the best occult bookstore on the West Coast, if not in America, for a long time. That was in San Francisco. And he was, I forget what rank he had in the Army, but he was at one time head of Army Intelligence, which is a pretty scary organization. And he founded this... I don't know if you could call it a religion, I guess, the Temple of Set. And that's a long story there. But he was a guy that he insisted on combing his hair so that it looked like he had two horns coming out of his head. And this was when he was in the Army. And the Army... insisted that he could not have this hairdo, and Aquino went to court and won to have this crazy hairdo. But
it's funny because the Army is kind of liberal about the esoterica they let in. I mean, you know, you can if you're a pagan and you you get a tombstone. If you die in combat and you get a tombstone put up, they'll put a pentagram on it, just the way they'll put a crescent for a Muslim or a cross for a Christian. So there's this weird like esoterica in the armed services that I've never heard a good, like there's a kind of softiness for it, which has always been surprising for me.
Yeah, I believe that you can practice Satanism while you're in the Army. And yeah, it's, but of course, then, you know, there's, you know, the intelligence agencies, they've always had an interest in the occult. And, you know, people like Jacques Vallée have explored this a little bit. You know, they, of course, in the 50s, there was this huge interest in the paranormal, especially remote viewing and these other so-called occult practices that the intelligence agencies were exploring. Of course, not for any other reason except to, have another tool in their toolkit. The funny thing, though, about a lot of the characters that I've met is that a lot of them, they're during the day, they're insurance salesmen or doctors or lawyers or plumbers, but they have this whole other life that they live, and they're exploring their particular interests. One of my sort of pet peeves in this business is to learn that a lot of people, even though they're collecting books and they're doing a lot of reading, their interests are pretty myopic. So you can have somebody who's only interested in theosophy, let's say, or only interested in UFOs, or only interested in conjuration. But what I've tried to do with my catalogs is to bring all the different threads together and put them in the catalog so that people can see that there's so much more out there than their particular interest. I'm not against anybody specializing in anything, but all these different strands inform each other, and that has been, I think, the hallmark of the really great occultists. You can go back in the past and talk about people like Paracelsus, who not only studied the occult, but he was also a medical doctor and a scientist and a botanist and an herbalist, and he was a rational thinker, and yet at the same time he cultivated this esoteric side of himself. And and then I've also, by virtue of having a mail order book business, I got to know people all over the world. I've had customers in China and Iceland and South Africa, and all kinds of people that, they just kind of defy definitions, some of these people. But one person I really do want to mention, is Thomas Hockle. It's hard to believe, but there is no really great occult library that's open to the public. Manly Hall had the greatest occult library in Los Angeles, the Philosophical Research Society. But that got decimated, sold off after Manly Hall died. So really, the only great library, there is no real public library. So it's been left up to the private individuals to preserve this knowledge. And that's what Thomas Hockle has done. He's in Austria, and he's a guy who is a self-made millionaire who early on decided he was going to build this great library. And he is one of those people that has tried to bridge all these different strands so that he doesn't just have books on the occult. He has books on sexology. He has books on religions. He has books on unexplained phenomena, Charles Fort, that kind of thing. And he's been a real inspiration. I hope people get a chance to look at these books that he's publishing now. He also publishes easily the greatest periodical in the world devoted to the occult. It's called Gnostica. I think there's been about 60 issues now, huge, thick volumes. And he's, through his library, he's collected all these scholars and thinkers, people like Jocelyn Godwin and Kreipl and Wouter Hanegraaff. And the other library I have to mention, of course, is the Bibliotheca Philosophica Hermetica in Amsterdam. That is the world's greatest library open to the public, and that was also started just by one man, not a university, not an academic organization. And we have a lot to thank these people for preserving this knowledge, which really a lot of it has been lost. And that's one of the exciting things about being in the book business for me, is I get to discover all these little strands of knowledge that have just been lost and forgotten and rejected.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be one of the special things that happens in this field, is that the role of books is different in some ways, or in periodicals as well, and book catalogs. It's different in some ways than other fields of knowledge because it's rejected knowledge. It means that more of it is lost, more of it is not cataloged or archived by official historical librarians and public libraries. And that means that it's more dependent on individual collectors. And a lot of these people are more unusual because they're interested in Yeti and Atlantis and you know chakras or whatever. So it's like there's these, it gives the, I mean, one of the reasons I always found esoteric book collecting so interesting is that the books themselves have a kind of extra charge to them, you know, especially the rare items, not just because they're rare the way that anything that's rare and desirable has a sort of charge, but that it itself is part of the secret that it's kind of talking about. So it's sort of like there's the esotericism of the content, but then there's the sort of esotericism of the books themselves, and that seems to draw a certain kind of power to it, a certain kind of charisma that, in a way, propels the whole obsession forward.
Well, right. Well, yeah, because books, since it is so difficult for somebody to explore these realms through academia, since we don't have universities that teach courses on alchemy or magic, we seekers have to do it on our own, and for that reason the books are so important. And that's why, you know, funny thing about book collecting, a lot of people don't realize that all the great libraries in the world, the vast majority of the books that are in those libraries were first collected by book collectors. And if book collectors don't collect a certain subject, there's a very good chance that that subject will not find its way to the great libraries of the world. So book collectors ought to remember that they are the frontline preservationists of knowledge. You know, a really good example of that is my friend Michael Horowitz, who started Flashback Books. I think he started that around the middle 1970s. And he started to collect books on the hippie revolution and psychedelics. And he started doing this at a time when librarians thought this was junk and, you know, or fluff, and no university library was collecting anything like that. But Michael collected that stuff. He was Tim Leary's literary executor, and Michael is, you know, right in the middle of it all. He lived the life himself, and slowly but surely he issued these marvelous catalogs of books, and slowly but surely academia started to pay attention, and now, you know, it's a respected field of study in a few places. So that's a good example. Another good example, I think, would be all the people that collected books on UFOs. I mean, just think, you know, what did people think of UFOs in the 70s? I mean, the academics had absolutely no interest in it. And now it's becoming a very serious field. And those books are in libraries now because of the few people that have collected them, and they build their library and then they die and it's donated to the library or sold or whatever. And it's a very important thing to remember.
Yeah, actually, just a couple weeks ago, we had the science fiction writer Jack Womack on the show, and he was talking about his UFO collection, which is part of his larger weird book collection, and the UFO stuff was acquired recently by Georgetown, by their archive library, and then he put out a really handsome book that shows a lot of the materials and the covers and the ephemera and things like that. And, you know, he was a really good example of what you're talking about. And it's funny. I mean, I remembered it because I never really felt like I was a collector. I was just buying books that I was interested in. I wasn't obsessing over any particular topic. There's a few things that I tried to kind of be somewhat consistent about. And then after a certain, I don't know what point it was, I kind of looked around and went, oh, wait, this is a library of like my interests. Because I have certain interests, and it has a, you know, a kind of consistency that on a piecemeal basis it didn't have. And then you know, I had to like kind of fess up to myself that it was like, no, I don't just buy books, I collect them. And then you go like, wow, it has its own kind of integrity. It's like it starts to build up, like magicians talk about the egregore, you know, this sort of thought form that's created through practice and intention. And in a way, libraries develop their own kind of spirits, or collections do, and they have their own kind of mystery to them. I mean, this is obviously going to be the case with esoteric stuff. But how do you feel about that? Almost like less about the not so much about the books about the esoteric, but sort of the esoteric life of books. Like there's some way in which there is a magic to books that's in a way right in front of our faces, but we don't quite tune into it. And I can only imagine that being a dealer at the level that you've been at, that you've really had some really good evidence for the magic of books.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. You know, there's this technique called psychometry, and it's an ancient belief that by touching something, you can absorb through some mysterious force or osmosis or something. You can pick up the vibrations of things. So, like a professional psychometrist, you could give them your grandfather's watch, and they would hold it in their hand and be able to relate things, impressions that they get about your grandfather. And it's a skill or an art or technique that maybe we all have, but some people have it to a much greater degree than others. And I won't say that I'm a psychometrist, but I have learned by handling hundreds of thousands of books that something does happen to me when I pick up a book. I get an immediate impression, a picture in my head. Ideas start to swirl in my head. And I think it's something that we don't pay attention to, most people. It's like a lot of psychic phenomena. It cracks me up that there's still people out there trying to prove that there's telepathy. When if you pay attention to your life, you realize that telepathy happens all the time. How many times have we thought about some friend who we haven't seen or thought about for years, and 5 minutes later the phone rings and it's that friend calling you? And, you know, but, you know, on a larger sense, some of the most amazing experiences for me have happened when I've gone to visit people in their libraries. And to go through, for example, many times I've gone through somebody's library who is dead, and it's being sold, and I'm going there to make an offer on it. And I start handling all these books, and wow, after a few hours, I've been absorbing all this information about this person that just comes from just handling their books. But of course, you know, we could get very deep into that subject. I mean, there's this tradition that letters are living beings, okay, and that idea is embedded in many occult schools of thought. So if letters are living beings, then obviously words are living beings. Then what do we say about a book? Could it possibly be full of thousands and thousands and thousands of living beings? And that's what we're touching. That's what we're holding, and that's what we're gazing upon. And I think that if we just would pay attention to these subtle impressions that we get, we can absorb so much more knowledge. And yeah, I've there have been so many times where I've handled a book and just read a few pages, and then later on had to describe the book just by reading a few pages and just handling it, or having it around my house, or having it just sitting on the sofa. I get all these impressions that turn out to be very accurate.
Yeah, I mean, there's no other way you could have done the catalogs the way you've done. You know, and I know that from my own research, experience, the ability to kind of weirdly absorb things, particularly when it's, you know, especially when it's a physical book, in your hand. And then there's the whole issue of weird, you know, research synchronicities, or the book falls on your head, or you're looking for something over here and it pops out over there. And, you know, that stuff must come in droves when you're doing collecting or looking for items. I mean, you've spent so much time combing through bookstores. There's this kind of, you know, people talk about the serendipity of finding something, you know, that's next to what you were looking for. Well, that's one level, but there's even more, like, really heavy serendipities that you're thinking about something, and then, you know, you find a book in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, in the wrong, misshelved on some other shelf. So there's a kind of synchronicity thing, that engine that seems to creep up around these things as well.
I can't tell you how many times somebody has called me, say, and I'm looking for a book by Thomas Taylor, and it's called The Metaphysics of Aristotle, and I have the book in my hand when they call. It's hard to explain what that could be. I've been in my bookstores where people have walked in and said, yeah, I'm looking for this old children's book. You probably never heard of it. And that book is sitting right on my counter. And, you know, the odds of that are impossible to calculate, you know, millions and millions to one. But, yeah, and also, you know, that's the thing about book collecting, too, is a lot of times people... By the way, I really like what you said about how you did the evolution that you had, where you finally realized you're a book collector. I notice this all the time. People tell me, oh, I'm not a book collector. And then I go over to their house, and they have thousands of books, and they're all neatly arranged. But, you know, one of the things that happens when people are collecting books is a lot of times they'll go to a shop, and they'll buy something, and they don't really know why they're buying it. But something calls to them. They buy it. They take it home. They put it on the shelf. Might be years later, but they realize, oh, that's why I bought that book. That fits into something that I'm studying now that they weren't even aware of years ago. I'm sure that's happened to you, Eric.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know it happened. That's the problem with that is then it's really hard to get rid of stuff because you never know.
Yeah.
Well, I might need that someday.
Yeah.
Which, because that's a whole other
issue.
Serious
book collectors don't get rid of their books. Usually they might pare it down a little bit, and maybe they have duplicates or that kind of thing. But you know, it's but the problem nowadays is book collecting, it's really kind of dying, Eric. There's this illusion out there that everything is on the internet, and it's just a disaster. There's even academics now talking about, quote, the end of knowledge, because since they claim that everything is on the internet, there's no reason for you to know anything personally, because you can access it through the internet. For one, the idea that everything on the internet, I mean, that is preposterous. I'm sitting in a house full of books right now, and I guarantee you the contents of 90% of these books is not on the internet and probably never will be. But the illusion, because of the illusion that it is on the internet, people don't find a good reason to collect books.
It's not even just that the idea that the material is online. It's also the whole way that changes the idea of what knowledge is, because there's one place you can go, you can access the information with a question, go to a search engine, and so that leads to that like the academics you were talking about, that idea like, well, we don't really need to own knowledge, which is what sort of to actually know something means in some ways you have some kind of possession over the knowledge. Well, you don't need that possession anymore. We're all in a, you know, it's all sharing economy. It's just something that you access, and it really changes the way people construct knowledge or construct models of the world. I think there are some interesting things about that. I think there are some interesting things about the way people are shifting what it means to know something in the modern era. But to do that to the exclusion of these older modes, particularly ones in the esoteric realm, because I think there's a particular power to the way in which books and esoteric books inform our interior lives and our sense of the world that I just don't think happens in the internet zone, and especially just the loss of bookstores and serendipity. And there's a thing in your essay where you talk about, and I've noticed this phenomenon. As soon as you wrote it, I was like, oh yeah, I've seen that, where people go into a bookstore and they have like one book they're looking for, and they go and they just ask at the counter, where is it? And they go there and it's not there, and they leave. Like for me, it's like, if I go into a bookstore, there's just no hope. I mean, if I can keep myself to three sections or something, then I'm like doing okay. I just go to the religion, go to esoteric, go to the literature, go to history, and like, okay, I can get out now. But the idea that you wouldn't browse, and that just seems natural to me. But of course, browsing is a skill like any other kind of nebulous skill. And it seems to me that is a particular skill that for very obvious reasons would be dwindling mighty fast these days.
It is. I think there's another thing that we have to bring up too, is that it's a scientific fact that when you read on paper, what you're doing is you're taking in light that is reflected off of a surface. But when you read on a screen, you're taking light that's being beamed into your eyes. And there's been a lot of research on this just recently to show that when we read letters, the light that's being beamed into our eyes, it is processed in different parts of our brain than it is when it's light reflected off paper. And the fact is when it's beamed into your eyes, you don't remember it as well. Your cognitive abilities are not as good as light that's being reflected into your eyes. And people are under this delusion that when you read on a screen, you're taking in that information just as well as you would be reading a book, but in fact, you're not.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. I think I've read some of those studies as well, and just the whole way that memory works as well. And you know, I can remember where on a page Like it's the upper left corner about a third of the way through a book. So I can find things that way as well as using an index. And so all of those tactile dimensions of memory are radically rewritten. And some people have some interesting solutions, but they don't get implemented because it's not where the money is. So we have about 10 minutes left. And of course we could rant about the internet, the degradation of culture for the remaining 10 minutes. But I wanted to ask you another question, which is one of the wonderful things that comes through your catalog and your essay. For me, it's a very Californian feeling, although I'm sure, you know, it's widespread across the world. But there's this wonderful openness. You know, you're willing to talk to the Satanists. You're willing to talk to the whack jobs. You're willing to talk to the pedants. You're interested in, you know, Yetis and UFOs, as well as alchemy and hermetic, esoteric, philosophical texts. How has that, I don't want to say how do you maintain it, but it just, you've been doing this for so long. How has it shifted over the decades? Have you become more skeptical, less skeptical, more interested in a few things, more open to it all? Like, how has that sense of being interested in so many things, so many domains of knowledge, so many modes of experiencing the world, how has that shifted or ballooned or lowered as the decades have rolled on?
Well, I think that you and I, Eric, are people who have a voracious appetite for knowledge. And we are also both incredibly curious about the world. My curiosity has been the engine that has propelled me through this book world, where I have always really been interested in everything. I mean, I don't just sell books on the occult, and I don't just read or collect books on the occult. I'm really interested in the whole span of history and knowledge. And so over the years, one thing I've realized is that there is so much more knowledge out there that people are unaware of. And yet, at the same time that we're having this explosion of knowledge on the internet and in books, I mean, you know, for the last 150 years, people have had access to more books than they ever had in the past. But simultaneously, there's a declining interest in being well-read and having your own sort of inner encyclopedia of knowledge about the world. And this is really reflected in academia, where you can have people have PhDs who only know about one subject. And that was the great achievement of a lot of the Victorian scholars. They're really some of my favorite people to read, because in that period, to be a man of knowledge and wisdom meant that you had a wide view of the world. And maybe you were a professional botanist, but you also knew about mountain climbing, and you tinkered with toy trains and rebuilt them, and you had this sort of eccentric, maybe, but wide view of knowledge. And I just don't see much of that anymore. People pigeonhole themselves, and society does it to us, and academia does it to us. So it's been kind of frustrating for me. All these years I've tried to provide people with the widest possible selection of texts, and yet more and more I find that people are just interested in one or two things, and they're really missing out on the world. And I think it's just so, isn't it so paradoxical, Eric, that we have the internet and all this knowledge you could just get at your fingertips, and yet is the world getting smarter? Is the world getting more knowledgeable? Are we wiser now than we were 100 years ago? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, it's deeply ironic, and even leaving aside the larger question of getting wiser or more intelligent, when the internet was first kind of congealing as a popular medium in the 90s, I was like, all right, here we come. It's going to be glass bead game city. We're going to see an intensification of the correspondences between different domains of knowledge, because it will all be coming at you through one interface. We're going to see ways of leaping between, you know, biology and history and architecture and, you know, cosmic philosophy and science fiction. And there'll be ways of like setting up these echo chambers, these labyrinths of echoing correspondences, which in a way is part of the attraction of esoteric thinking, is this idea of correspondences, that things in different domains have secret connections or resonances that reverberate through the totality. And I totally thought that's what we were going to see more of with the internet, was like this attempt to like not synthesize all knowledge, but to kind of play with it like a great, you know, organ of all of these different domains of knowledge. But that hasn't really happened.
No, we've become balkanized. People are now just hunkered down with their own little realities. I think it's proof that the internet is not making us wiser. It's doing just the opposite. It's we're just being remotely programmed, and I think we need a revolution in thinking, and a greater respect for all kinds of knowledge, and quit being so judgmental and be more open-minded about other cultures and other historical periods and ways of seeing the world. And that's one of the things I love about your books, Eric, and these podcasts. You're really bringing attention to areas of knowledge that are just being forgotten. Just like you say, with the internet, you'd think there'd be more of it, but there isn't. But we struggle on anyway and do the best we can.
You know, even though this is on a different topic, I also just wanted to mention the work that you've done, you know, for many years on literacy and teaching to, you know, homeless kids and, you know, getting down there. And so it's not just like you're interested in, you know, highbrow esoteric researchers. It's like your commitment, your spiritual commitment to knowledge and learning and reading has really also led you to do a lot of work that, you know, isn't making you any cake, and you know, is probably pretty difficult sometimes to see what people are putting up with.
But it's in a certain way, my work with kids has been the greatest joy. I have so much sympathy for children today. They're really preyed upon. They're raised by institutions, not by communities. And I remember what it was like to be a kid and be interested in something, and to have an adult around that can support your interests and show you how exciting the world could be. It's so important. And nowadays, children, they know, even though we have these, you know, this public education system, and it's obvious that they're really not learning much, and they've lost their curiosity. And if I could do anything with the kids, I want to support their curiosity, because that's what's made my life so interesting and enjoyable, is exploring my interests. It's that simple.
What do you think do you think curiosity is naturally there and it gets kind of beat out of kids, or do you think it's something that needs to be encouraged
at all? No. Children are born they're born, they're little scientists right off the bat. They're curious. I mean, babies, they put things in their mouth, they roll around, and so they want to know about life. It's the life urge in us, and but it's squashed. One of the worst things that we've witnessed now is that reading for pleasure starts to decline around the age of 11. That's when people start to lose their love of reading for pleasure. And that's because of the way schools force-feed books to kids and force-feed knowledge. We've got to turn it all around. George Bernard Shaw has a great quote, something like, what we want to see in education, or what we want to see is children running after education, not education running after children. You know, it's already there in us. Let's just support it, and we don't have to force anything on them. But instead, that's what we're doing. It's just a mass force feeding, and really turns kids off. And we've all witnessed that.
I think there's also technology in that. I hadn't heard that statistic about 10, you know, but it kind of makes sense. Also, you know, 10, 11, 12 is when you're hitting puberty. And now the way in which social media plugs into the kind of social gamesmanship that's associated with puberty and like understanding your status and your role in relationship to others. And social media is so powerfully running off of that kind of psychology that I can imagine it's just like a freight train coming your way, you know, as you shift into a different way of relating to the world. That technology is just going to so change the way in which you interact with writing, with language, and you know, best of luck, kids. You know, it's a tough one, you know, especially when your whole consciousness and worldview has been shaped by books, you know, that we're Gutenberg people in a post Gutenberg world in many ways. But anyway, Todd, we have to wrap it up there, and I wanted to give a shout out. You have a website. What's your website's address?
Well, it's my name, Pratum, PRATUM.com, and I'm just about to release Catalog 100, which is kind of a historic catalog. It's going to be completely unique. It's going to be unlike any of my previous catalogs. It's going to be a surprise.
Well, we're going to have to end it there, but go to the website, sign up. So, Todd, thank you very much, and for all of you out there, keep in mind.